Monster Man, Episode 90, Devil Dog to Doom Bat.
Stop missing with the Monster Man, it was a bad plan, but I had to get to town on it.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming supplements of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm looking at the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In this second season of Monster Man, I'm reading my way through the 1981 Fiend Folio, produced by TSR UK for the first edition of Advanced Dungeons & Dragons. In this episode, we're going to continue our trip through the D section of the Fiend Folio. We're going to look at the Dire Corby, the Disenchanter, and the Doom Bat. But before we do that, it's time to thank some new patrons and answer some listener mail. Let's start by thanking some patrons. Yes, these are people who've gone to patreon.com/monsterman and pledged as little as $1 a month to support the show. And if, like both of today's patrons, you're pledged at the $2 or higher level, you'll also get access to my second podcast, Patron Deities, in which I take a look at the Deities and Demigods supplement and talk about using religion and mythology in your Dungeons & Dragons games. Or, I guess, your fantasy role-playing games in general. Anyway, first off, thank you very much, Albert Anderson. And the second person I want to thank today is Edwin King. And you might say, wait a minute, James, I've listened to every episode of Monster Man, and I have an incredible memory, so I know that you thanked Edwin before. Well, that's right. But I'm thanking Edwin for increasing his pledge, and that means that Edwin, like everyone else who pledges at the $5 level or higher, is going to get to choose his own episode of Monster Man, and in fact, it's going to be out tomorrow. So thank you very much, Edwin. And also, Edwin is a sponsor of the second Monster Man contest. So if you go over to the voting post, you'll see a link to his online bookshop, Diplomatist Books. Check it out. So thank you once again to Albert and Edwin, and to all my patrons. Next up, let's answer some listener mail. I got a message from Sebastian Wakely, and Sebastian was replying to some stuff I said in episode 89, where I was talking about the Styx Devil, aka the Satanic Angel. And Sebastian, I think, thought I was being a little unfair on the old Styx Devil, and he has a point. Because the Styx Devil, I said it was mechanically or, like, thematically not that distinct from other devils, but it is a little bit mechanically distinct, and Sebastian pointed this out. He said it does have this ability that other devils don't have, which is this power to imprison people. And that was in my notes, but I didn't include it in the episode in the end. But I think it's a fair point that, you know, in keeping with this thing where it collects people's souls, it has this ability to imprison people. So that's sort of, you can see how they would go hand in hand, right? People sell their souls to Geryon, I guess. And then the Styx Devils are the ones that kind of go out and do the collecting. And, you know, that's a fun image, and as Sebastian pointed out, it implies a lot of potential scenarios. This is a recurring trend both in the Monster Manual and in the Fiend Folio, that a lot of monsters that come with sort of implicit scenario hooks, but in this era, they're never really spelled out. So you have to kind of be alert to the nuances of each entry in order to see, like, oh, what is this monster for? And although I did note that down, I kind of glossed over it in the episode, and I probably should have paid it more attention. Anyway, thank you for writing in, Sebastian. I also want to point out that over on the Monster Man G Plus community, Guy Fullerton has been answering some of my questions about the origins of the Bullywug, specifically the role that they played in Dwellers of the Forbidden City. And this has been, like, shedding some further light on the process of creating the Fiend Folio, which, as we know, was kind of a weird collaboration between TSR UK, under the management of Don Turnbull, and the parent company back in the States. In fact, I don't know if TSR UK was, like, what its status was here. I mean, originally, this was something that came out of White Dwarf, right? This is the period when Games Workshop was the importer, right? Was the licensee in the UK, and then TSR UK became a thing, I guess, around this time, right? But I'd have to look it up. Anyway, so I'm going to say some stuff later on about, you know, the interaction between TSR UK and TSR US in the Fiend Folio, and a lot of that comes from stuff that I learned from Guy in that conversation. So, all right, the first monster on our list is the Devil Dog, but I'm not going to talk about the Devil Dog in this episode because I already did a special episode. It was one of our patron-requested special episodes on Devil Dogs, and so you can just scroll back through the feed and find that one. It's not that long ago. They were requested by Robert Faulkner. Yeah, I think we got to say a lot of fun stuff about them that, to be honest, is also going to apply to, like, the Hound of El Omen and the Kushi and all these other different animal monsters when we get to them. But so that was the Devil Dog. In the episode, I don't think I mentioned that the Devil Dog is credited to Louis Boschelli, I don't know which one it is, but yeah, I don't want to leave him out. So let's move on to a creature that we haven't already covered, the Dire Corby, created by Jeff Windham. You know, it is rare in the Fiend Folio that you get a monster who is let down by its illustration, whether that illustration is by Alan Hunter or by Russ Nicholson. And of course, there are other artists in this book, as we shall see, but those two do the vast majority of the lifting. But Alan Hunter really did not quite capture the Dire Corby here. And, it's a shame, because you can kind of see how the Dire Corby should work, but it doesn't quite from the entry. Okay, so Dire Corbies are humanoid birds, but here they're just kind of represented as men with bird heads and feet, and they're wearing little loincloths, which, I don't know, I mean, I understand that TSR didn't want to put too many monsters' bikini areas in the illustrations, I get that, but at the same time, there's just something a little bit silly about wearing a loincloth, especially if you're meant to be, like, this berserk barbarian, like, I guess they run at people shrieking doom, but also they do still have some modesty taboos. Like, you just cover it with feathers or something, I don't know. Anyway, the Dire Corby has a pretty silly illustration, and I think that's a big part of its problem, because other than that, it doesn't have a hook, right? And this is something that we run into a lot with fight monsters. So in Dungeons & Dragons, you got a variety of different types of monsters, and the Dire Corby are definitely fight monsters. They're low intelligence, so, you know, chances are you're not really, like, negotiating with them or, you know, having complex political situations. And they're basically sort of primitive, you know, underground-dwelling caveman types. Okay, fine, there are lots of monsters in Dungeons & Dragons that are primitive underground-dwelling caveman types, but usually they have a little bit more kind of folkloric or fictional hook to them, so that you already have something to kind of attach to when you're encountering them. You don't really have that with the Dire Corby, and they don't have a gimmick, right? They don't have either a narrative or a mechanical gimmick. They're just two-hit-die dudes who live underground and fight people. I think this may be further complicated by, I mean, I don't know, when someone says Corby, do you think, okay, that means a crow? Because, I mean, Corby just means crow, and it has this kind of folkloric ring to it, right? Like, when you think of Corby, you think of the song, the Twa Corbies. Okay, looking it up, I don't know whether I should properly call it a song or a poem. I'm familiar with it as a piece of music. Anyway, it's about these two Corbies who are sitting looking at the body of a slain knight and thinking about how they're going to have a delicious meal on him, and everybody else has just forgotten him. Anyway, I think if you're going to do something with the Dire Corby, you have to start from there. You have to start with the idea that they're scavengers, and that they're, you know, birds of ill omen, as the raven and the crow are thought to be in a lot of cultures, because, you know, they feast on corpses. So think of the Dire Corby as, you know, basically the supersized version of that. And then, you know, maybe either go in the more magical direction with it, where you're like, oh, well, they are, you know, sort of like harbingers of doom. Like, the Dire Corbies tend to show up when things are about to go bad because they're, you know, they're waiting to come in and prey on, you know, the corpses of civilizations. You know, they're so much bigger and more sophisticated than, like, a crow. You know, crows feed on the body of an animal, but the Dire Corbies will feed on the corpse of a society. And then that's also kind of like looting, right? So they collect treasure in the same way that they would, like, eat up the actual flesh of a dead body. Alternatively, you could just say, yeah, they're crow-like, you know, they're big scavengers, and, you know, they behave like this, and go with the more ecological version of it. My version is always going to be the more kind of supernatural one, but then that's just my aesthetic, generally. So I think you can do something with the Dire Corby, and I think you can do it because, you know, they're Corbies, they're linked to crows and ravens, and we already have a bunch of ideas about what crows and ravens are like. And so that they have a punch, they have a meaning to them. It's just not really present in the entry, and I think partly that's because the illustration is not very atmospheric. I do think the fact that the Dire Corby shouts doom in its own language as it runs at you is connected to the idea of it being a bird of ill omen, so I'm not just pulling this out of thin air here. All right, next up we have the Disenchanter. Now, I mentioned earlier that Guy Fullerton linked me to some interesting stuff about the process of creating the Fiend Folio, and one of those things was that there were some monsters that Gary Gygax actually wanted removed from the Fiend Folio because he didn't like them. And he instructed Lawrence Schick, who I guess was acting as an editor at TSR at that time. He said, go ahead and take these out, but Schick just ran them anyhow. I guess he was leaving the company and, you know, maybe the wires got crossed or he did like them or something. Anyway, they wound up in the final publication. Of course, he's coming from reminiscences of many years later, so, you know, maybe the story is more complex than that. But I do think that it's possible to see some connections between the things that Gygax did not like. Typically, they're either things that are very mechanical or they're very silly. And the only exception there is the Kenku, which I think maybe he didn't like the illustration, because he seems to have thought of the Kenku as silly, but I don't think that's how, like, it has subsequently been interpreted. But I agree that the Kenku illustration in the Fiend Folio is very different from how the Kenku has gone on to be portrayed. Anyway, I mention this because one of the creatures that Gygax wanted removed is the Disenchanter, and you can sort of see why. It's a bright blue camel elephant thing that has a magic nose that disenchants magical items. And the idea is that it has this weird metabolism where it feeds on the magical energy that empowers your weapons or your whatevers. And so once it has eaten it all up, it's gone. On paper, this makes a lot of sense, or at least in terms of, like, the progress of a D&D game, because this is basically just the, like, Rust Monster EX Plus, right? The thing about the Rust Monster is that it, you know, it eats metal and it will destroy your stuff, and everybody's terrified of it. So, in theory, the Disenchanter should be the same. And I don't know that there's necessarily any difference between one of them being a big blue camel fant and the other one being a giant flea. You know, those are also both kind of silly images. And yet, the Rust Monster works, and the Disenchanter sort of doesn't. I can't decide whether that's because the Disenchanter kind of feels like Hex's own gotcha monster. Like, the DM has given you, you know, that Holy Avenger, and then, you know, the next morning he's changed his mind, and he's put a Disenchanter into the game. Furthermore, one of the things that you would immediately think of, oh, I should say, the Disenchanter was created by Roger Musson. One of the things that you would immediately think of when you think of, you know, the Disenchanter running around trying to, like, slap things with its trunk and drain the magical energy out of them, is how does it hit things that aren't in use, right? So, you know, if that player's got that, you know, magical shield slung on her back, or a wand of fireballs tucked into the top of her boot, you know, how does the Disenchanter hit those with its trunk? Because it will go, it can sort of sense the magical energy, so it will go for the most nutritious target, the thing that has the most magical energy in it, which might not necessarily be something that you're holding in your hand when you're trying to fight it. And what it says is, the referee will have to decide. Thanks, pal. I could do that for myself. Like, I already know that I have to decide things. And in particular, this feels like the kind of rule that's going to cause fights. Again, I'm envisioning my teenage self trying to run this game. I don't know why, since by the time I was a teenager, this book had been out for 10 years at least. But anyway, I'm envisioning my young self trying to run this game, and all I can see is that, like, inviting me to make a judgment call about whether a grudge monster takes away my PC's beloved Frostbrand just seems like hurt feelings waiting to happen. Again, it sort of feels like a monster that should work. Like, you're going to see the PCs, like, getting tiny magic items and throwing them over there as bait to lure the things away so that they can sneak past. You know, that all makes sense. But there's something, I mean, it just has, like, one element too many. If it were a thing that destroyed your magical items, but it didn't look like a big blue goon, maybe it would work. Or if it were something else that looked like a big blue goon, but, you know, I mean, just whatever, like, maybe it's just one thing too many, right? We can identify some sense of, like, a core 70s, 80s Dungeons and Dragons aesthetic, and then say, like, well, yeah, you can twist one of those things, but you can't have a monster that, first, has kind of a video gamey mechanic, and second, looks bizarrely out of keeping with our pseudo-medieval aesthetic. You can't have both. Maybe, I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud here. Anyway, that's the Disenchanter. It's one of those monsters that, in principle, there should be nothing wrong with, and maybe it just needs a rewrite to make it make sense, but as it's written, it looks a bit daft, and I think that that's really what puts people off about it. Finally, we come to the Doombat, created by Julian Lawrence. Doombats are great. I don't really have anything to say about them. They are great big bats, and they have a sonic yip like a normal bat, but it is so loud that they can emit, like, this piercing sonic wave that disorients everybody and gives them penalties on stuff. It's not killer. It's just really annoying. And it's just like a little mechanical fillip on an otherwise perfectly fine monster, right? Like a big leathery monstrosity with a 25-foot wingspan that comes dive-bombing down on you in this gigantic cave. Maybe Doombats are what live in the eaves of a giant's house, like I was saying way back in those episodes about giants. Yeah, I think Doom Bats are pretty great. I don't have a whole lot to contribute about them, but that's because they're solid monsters. What's really interesting about the Doom Bat and its relationship to the Fiend Factory is the Doom Bat that appears in the Fiend Factory column is completely different. It is a giant bat, sure. It's undead. Its whip-like tail has a powerful paralyzing effect, like a ghoul's touch. It doesn't have the sonic scream, and did I mention that it's undead? So it really is quite different. It's wound up as a more naturalistic kind of dire bat. Well, that's really interesting, because the Doom Bat in its undead form seems fine, right? I mean, vampires, bats, sure, it all makes sense. Interesting. They went with a more kind of naturalistic monster. Which is a trend that we're seeing sort of like the Fiend Folio kind of has a very split personality, right? Because it has a lot of very naturalistic monsters, even science fiction-y ones that are very kind of like, this is a believable animal behavior, right? Those Ian Livingstone kind of monsters. But then it also has all kinds of goony stuff, so I don't see, you know, they didn't eliminate the Doom Bat because a giant undead bat is inconsistent with the prevailing aesthetic of the book. It would have fit right in. Interesting. Just a little mystery. Anyway, that's all the time that we have for today. Please join me in the next episode of Monster Man. Well, actually, the next episode's going to be a special episode on Wednesday, a bonus episode. But then on Friday, we're going to talk about dragons, but not your regular fire-breathing dragons. We're going to talk about dragons from Chinese mythology, which are different in a number of important ways. So please join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. Do you have a favorite monster? Do you have something you'd like me to talk about? Find me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or send me an email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. If you want to support the podcast, you can do so at patreon.com/monsterman, where you'll find lots of extra bonus content and my brand new show, Patron Deities, in which I explore the deities and demigods advanced Dungeons & Dragons book. Check it out. Thanks for listening.